You're listening to In the Vault, a KPMG banking industry podcast series.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Liz Lamadou, a principal in KPMG's Banking and Capital Markets Tax Practice. And today I'm joined by my partner, Stephanie Humphrey, who specializes in accounting methods and credits for financial institutions. Welcome, Steph.
Thanks so much for having me.
Glad you're here. So today, we're going to dive into some recent and maybe upcoming changes in the treatment of research and development expenses and what the changes mean for banks. You'll recall the TCJA changed the treatment for these expenses a few years ago and required taxpayers to capitalize many of their research and development expenses. And then we had a much anticipated reversal of that capitalization requirement. That happened in this summer's OB3 legislation, although, as always, lots of nuances to consider. So, Steph, why don't we start at the beginning? Give us a high-level overview of the changes that we're seeing with these expenses and why it now matters for banks.
Sure, absolutely. So I think we found over the period of 2022 to 2024 for banks that these types of costs are actually quite large in a lot of cases and maybe higher than anticipated, because 174 costs include all costs related to software development. For our banking taxpayers in particular, those numbers can be quite significant. So this change with OB3 was certainly welcomed in a lot of ways. It provides some options, and we'll talk through these in a little bit, but it provides options for both reversing some of the capitalization that was taken in the 22, 23, and 24 tax years, as well as being able to currently deduct some 174 costs for 2025 and forward. All of the changes are really focused on the deductibility of domestically performed R&E activity. So OB3 did not make any changes to anything that's done outside of the U.S. And that was sort of anticipated. We knew that there was really not a lot of incentive for the government to change foreign perform research. They really do want to incentivize this activity in the U.S. So the primary changes are around those areas. There is a lot of complexity to these changes, though. The benefits are there's some optionality, which we can talk through. But of course, that brings some complexity with selecting which approach to take. And then there are some also knock-on implications of the changes with regard to the research credit and some of the other places where expenses are allocated, for example, under Section 861 and other provisions of the code that have interplay with 174.
Yeah, that was a great overview, Steph. And I want to layer in a couple more things as we think about this for banking, and that is the capitalization over the last few years really had the impact of increasing taxable income. It increased DTAs, which can be bad for regulatory capital purposes, although maybe it's a better DTA than what might otherwise be an NOL. But I think what a lot of banks saw is it increased capacity and allowed them to utilize credits that might have otherwise become credit carry forwards. So it seems like we have a lot to model out as we think about how banks are going to move forward in changing this. And like you mentioned, what happens now as they maybe want to expense some of that was previously capitalized?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's interesting. You know, the first thought, of course, is you can accelerate all of the unamortized portion of the prior capitalization in your 2025 tax year. And there's a couple of options for doing that. One is to accelerate it all into 2025. Another option is to accelerate it, but split it evenly between 25 and 26. And so that seems initially quite favorable, very welcome. But I have found, surprisingly, there's a lot of modeling that is going into our clients making a decision on which approach to take, or in some cases to continue amortizing those costs. And one of the biggest ones that I think I've most commonly see is the corporate alternative minimum tax, CAMT impacts for a lot of taxpayers. These numbers are so large that it's flipping them into a potential CAMT liability that they would not have otherwise had. So that's a really common one that I've seen that I think was probably not expected initially. There are other modeling considerations, as mentioned, you know, expense allocation considerations, what are those costs, just impacting taxable income overall, possibility for BEAT implications as well. So I do think it is a pretty significant modeling exercise to understand which of the entities in the group that the U.S. filing group have 174, and what are the various considerations for those costs, whether you want to continue to amortize or accelerate some of that into 25 or 25 and 26.
I agree. It seems like it's a really important modeling exercise. And I will note, again, specific to banks with a lot of credits in their portfolio, getting into a CAMT year can cause an issue on how you utilize that CAMT credit going forward because of the way the credits are prioritized in future years. So a lot to consider there.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. The credit capacity piece is another one that does come up a lot, because a lot of our, especially banking taxpayers, have significant credits that they don't want to lose the opportunity to utilize.
So far we've been thinking about what to do for the 22 to 2024 on amortized basis, but how about 2025 and beyond? Can you talk to us about the go forward options and walk us through some of the key choices and things taxpayers might be weighing for that?
Yes, absolutely. I think similar, although maybe even a little bit more complicated than the unamortized basis piece, there are a lot of options for the go forward 25 and future costs. And I think my first observation, so just to level set really quickly, the OB3 legislation provided essentially two options plus a potential election: the option to currently deduct domestically performed R&E under 174 Cap A, so that's a Cap A is a new section under 174. The other option was to capitalize and amortize those costs over a period of not less than 60 months under 174 Cap AC. So those are the two kind of accounting method options. And then there is still the option for a Section 5090 election to capitalize a certain dollar amount of costs that would otherwise have been deducted under 174 Cap AA and amortize those over 10 years.
So comparing those to old 174 law, it's not exactly the same, right?
Exactly. And I think that's what's really interesting. I think most of us, many practitioners, really expected that they might revert back to a lot of the options that existed pre-mandatory capitalization. So taxpayers had optionality to select a deducting or capitalizing method almost on an annual basis via cutoff method change. They could also do that on a project-by-project basis if they wanted to capitalize some costs and deduct others. And in the RevProc that was issued in particular in late August of this year, after OB3 was signed, we found that most of those options really do not exist. So taxpayers really are locked in to the accounting method they choose, i.e. currently deducting or the capitalizing and amortizing over a period of 60 months or more that I noted earlier, that you're kind of locked into that method for effectively 5 years. And there's no optionality to do that, some portion of that, or do that on a project by project basis. So I think it is a really important decision that taxpayers are going to have to make in 2025. I think from having spoken to many taxpayers in the industry, I'm frequently seeing a focus on a method of currently deducting, and then the possibility to rely on things like the 5090 election to capitalize a portion of those costs where necessary from a planning or kind of lever perspective, because most taxpayers view that locking themselves into a requirement to capitalize all costs for at least 5 years is not an ideal scenario.
Yeah, it does feel like some flexibility or optionality is key, particularly if we think about like the capital planning play. I assume that rolls into these decisions as well.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, there are some taxpayers in the industry, if they have NOLs that they're still kind of working through, it is helpful to continue to have the possibility of a 174 DTA instead of an NOL. So continuing to capitalize might be favorable. And 5090, actually, benefit in that fact pattern is 5090's amortization period is 10 years. So it is on the longer side. Now, of course, for some taxpayers, that is a downside. They may have a desire to capitalize some, but not all, but they don't necessarily want to do it over that long of a period of time. So it is a real consideration. But I think the common things similar to the unamortized basis are considerations around CAMT, considerations around BEAT, considerations around credit capacity, and absolutely regulatory capital modeling and options and the different scenarios for that as well.
And there certainly is a tie-in with Section 41 and 280C and the R&D credit that we know a lot of banks take because of their internally developed software?
Yes, absolutely. And I think these are really important. They may be obvious to some, but I think they're also easily overlooked because they're not directly related to 174. But a couple of key changes there that I think are important to highlight. First, the changes in Section 41 articulate now that in order for a cost to be a Section 41 qualified research expenditure, it shall first be a Section 174 cost. So what's really important there is there is now pretty clearly no optionality to treat something that might be a 174 cost as something different than 174 and also claim it for the research credit. So I think there's going to be a really important exercise going forward for taxpayers to have some sort of mapping to show what's included in their tax return, what is treated as 174 eligible, and then the funnel down to what portion of that is credit eligible. I think that will be an ask of the IRS early on in any IRS exam, so taxpayers should be prepared for that. The other key change, which unfortunately has an immediate effective tax rate hit for all of our taxpayers, most likely, or those that were previously claiming research credits at least, would be the Section 280C changes. So Section 280C, as some may recall, was rewritten in TCJA, and effectively the way that it was written meant that many taxpayers did not make a 280C election, so they did not reduce their research credit for their amount of for the tax rate, but also did not reduce their 174 expenses. So they were getting full 174 expense amounts and a full gross credit amount, which was really favorable from an effective tax rate perspective. OB3 rewrote those rules and made it clear that in pretty much all cases, taxpayers will likely be making a 280C election, which is going to be kind of an immediate 21% hit on their otherwise expected research credit for the year. So, not ideal news on that front.
And is that for go forward only?
Great question. Yes, that is go forward only in almost all cases. There are some limited exceptions for small business taxpayers that may choose to make amendments to prior year returns. In this industry, I have not actually observed yet any taxpayers that are interested in doing that. So I caveat it a little bit, but for 95-90% of taxpayers, yes, it is go forward only. So beginning in the 2025 tax year.
Okay, well, that is good news because I think we certainly get a lot of questions around what happens for 2022 to 2024 with that 280C. So,
Absolutely. Yes, that definitely
positive.
agree.
So, Steph, another question I've been hearing a lot is, can taxpayers stop calculating their domestic R&E costs?
Yes, that's a great question, and definitely one I get a lot as well. And I think that's an important thing to think about because, of course, taxpayers have limited resources internally and externally, so they don't want to dedicate a lot of resources to efforts that ultimately don't have a big impact on the return. In general, my answer to most taxpayers on that is it depends. It depends a little bit on your profile. What might be impacted by your 174 costs? Are you definitely going to consistently currently deducting domestically performed costs, or is there a possibility you would want to make a 59E election? Do you have any expense allocation considerations for your 174 pool? And/or do you need to know what those domestically performed 174 costs are for other purposes? There are some newer provisions or some changes in provisions from OB3 that could require the need to know what the number is, even if you're currently deducting it. We can certainly talk about that as well. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the research credit. Research credit does require that a cost is first a 174 cost. So it is really important to be able to show what those 174 costs are before determining what is el credit eligible. So all that to say, I think there's the possibility to adjust scope, revise how you look at things, but I do expect that most taxpayers will still need to do some work around their 174 costs, even those that are only performed within the US.
Thanks for that answer. And then one other topic I wanted to raise is that it appears there in all of this there may be a surprise winner, and that's in the FIDE change. Banks haven't traditionally focused on that due to the exclusion of financial services, but I'm certainly hearing a lot about that recently.
Yeah, I think it has been really interesting that I agree. Most financial institutions really were not focused on what we previously called FIDE or FDII. New term is FIDE, because all income that is financial services income is excluded from the benefit. So of course, the vast majority of banking taxpayers, their income is going to be financial services income, so not that compelling. What has always been eligible for this benefit is income related to things like back office kind of services, for example, IT or software development services that are potentially performed in the US and charged out to foreign affiliate CFCs, for example. Those have always been eligible for the benefit. However, you know, typically you'd be focused on just the markup portion of that income that might generate a benefit, because the expenses would also be allocated against that and reduce kind of the opportunity. There are a couple of key things that changed with OB3 with FIDE, now FIDE. First, expenses that are interest or R&E are no longer allocated against eligible income. And second, QBI is no longer a reduction to the potential qualification. So those are all favorable changes from a FIDE perspective, will be helpful to all taxpayers. But I think the observation is, if you have income that might be related to performing R&E, for example, do you potentially end up in a situation where you have income that's eligible for this benefit, but the expenses are no longer allocated because they are otherwise R&E, and then you have the opportunity, potential opportunity, to get a much more significant benefit than you may have historically. So I do think this is an area that's important for taxpayers to take a look at. This change is effective for 2026 tax years and forward. So there's a little bit of time to do some analysis and get your arms around it, but definitely something to consider.
And that income might be something like technology type related income?
Yes, it's certainly for banks, I would expect that to be things in their IT services, software development kind of realm that might have opportunity for this.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for that. And another area, we have a little bit of time, like you said, but another area to take a close look at if applicable.
Absolutely. Yep.
So, Steph, this has been great. I appreciate you breaking us down the new 174. Any final thoughts or any suggestions for banks as they prepare for 2025? I mean, now's the time with year end upon us to start thinking about this.
Absolutely. Hopefully by the time this podcast is out, most of our calendar year taxpayers will have at least completed their 2024 tax returns and will very much be moving into all things 2025. So I do think, as we've said a few times, but we'll say it one more time, the modeling exercise is key. Understanding how to treat the unamortized basis, as well as what taxpayers want to do on a go-forward basis, and what the knock-on implications of those things could be related to CAMT or BEAT or capital capacity or credit capacity. There's lots of potential implications. So while many of these changes were welcome, I don't think it made our tax jobs any easier. So more considerations as we look forward to 2025 tax returns.
More fun indeed. Well, thank you, Steph. This has been really helpful, and I appreciate you joining me. So I look forward to having you back again, and we can talk more about 174 and all things accounting methods.
Thanks so much for the time, Liz. It was great talking.
And to our audience, thank you for joining us today. This is Liz Lamadou on behalf of KPMG's Banking and Capital Markets Tax Practice. I look forward to talking again soon.
Thanks for listening to In the Vault with KPMG. Be sure to subscribe to this series to be notified of new episodes.